Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Batting first, producer Tim Howard.
Cool. Wait, I'm just going to get my level here. Da-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba-do. It is such a beautiful day.
Beautiful. I think it's got to be like 75 degrees out or something. Sunny.
This is Patrick Purdon. He's a professor in anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and works at Mass General Hospital.
You want to just tell me where we are?
Yeah. We're standing right now in front of the Bullfinch building.
And I went up to talk to him because in that building...
This is the one with the Ether Dome?
Ether Dome is inside this building.
Is the story of the day that, you could say, humanity emerged from the Dark Ages. Oh, you laugh now. Just wait.
Okay, here we go. It's on the fourth floor. It's on the fourth floor of this building.
We headed in, up three flights of stairs, into this room.
What a cool room. Oh my God. Is this like, how would you describe it?
It's like a mini amphitheater, right?
It's also got this awesome dome.
It's this beautiful domed room with light streaming down from above.
Like, the acoustics in here are crazy. It must have been terrifying, though, if you actually heard somebody screaming.
I mean, it's so resonant in here, the screams would have been deafening and absolutely would have been terrifying.
What is this place?
Well, this was an operating room.
Oh.
And back in the 1800s, when this room was really in use...
Being in an operation was so painful, it was often permanently damaging to a patient's emotional state.
This is Julie.
I'm Julie Fenster. I write about American history.
She wrote a book called Ether Day, which goes into a lot of detail about the dark, dark days of surgery in the early 1800s. Back then, during surgery, there were no painkillers, and patients were awake. Probably more awake than they'd ever been in their whole lives.
Some of the patients remembered the sound of their limb dropping to the ground, or the saw going through their sinew and bones. The smell of their own body being cut into. Usually a surgeon would employ six burly men to hold a patient down. And instead of having an operation, some people committed suicide before they would face going into an operating room, which were usually located on the top floor of a hospital, in part because the hospital really didn't do itself a lot of good to have the screams heard by passersby.
This is such a cool room. Here we are at the top of the Ether Dome.
But then, everything changes. October 16th, 1846. It's a Friday morning.
I assume the room is full?
The room is absolutely full.
The students were all lined up to watch.
Crowded in the bleachers because they'd heard something big was going to go down. And right there in the middle of the room is...
the most esteemed surgeon in America, Dr. John Warren.
About to do an operation. He brought in a patient who needed a tumor taken out of his neck, and he was just about to slice into the guy.
Just about to start the surgery.
When this mustachioed fellow bursts in, a dentist.
William T.G. Morton.
And he basically said to Warren something that must have sounded completely nuts. I can erase that man's pain. He didn't actually use those words. He actually had an appointment with Warren. But according to Julie, he did have a bag.
He had a bag filled with gas.
A gas called ether.
And Dr. Warren, who had the scalpel raised...
he puts it down.
...stands aside and says, with great sarcasm...
Well, sir, your patient is ready.
Wait a second, had he ever tested this?
He claimed to have tried it out on some dental patients and...
on his dog, on himself, and on his goldfish.
Nice.
So Morton gets to work.
Morton sets up his gear, fills up the inhaler...
puts it up to the guy's face.
And actually, because the valve system had just been constructed and he hadn't tested it, he actually literally had to manually operate the valves with every inhale and exhale of the patient. So he administers the ether using this inhaler. After about 3 or 4 minutes, the patient becomes unconscious. And just at that moment, Morton turns to Warren and says,
"Your patient, sir."
Dr. Warren brings the scalpel down to the patient's neck and cuts. And really, for the first time in that room, you could hear the scalpel. You could hear the breathing.
The silence was far more deafening than all the screams that had ever been heard in that operating theater. No squirming, no moving, no bulging eyes, no clenched fists.
It must have felt like a miracle.
The news of the operation went around the world as fast as anything. News of, you know, war or peace didn't travel faster than this. By the end of the year, doctors in Europe were using surgical anesthetics.
In basically the blink of an eye, the most painful, horrible experience possibly imaginable became routine, even forgettable.
But also deeply peculiar, as was made clear to us when we talked a while back with one of our regulars.
Carl Zimmer.
Well, my wife and I, we were watching this movie one night. It was called Birth, starring Nicole Kidman.
Did you like it?
I hated it.
No! It's one of my favorites.
Well, okay, I'm sitting there and I'm hating the movie.
You're hating this movie?
Well, I'm just wondering, like, why am I reacting so negatively to this movie? I'm just in such a bad mood. Mm. I'm feeling lousy, and I think it's the movie. And I stand up and I say, oh, wait a minute. My abdomen is in incredible pain.
Oh, so it's not the movie.
It's not the movie. It's me.
Appendix about to burst.
We go to the hospital, and maybe 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, they're prepping me for surgery. They, you know, put an IV in me. And then they're like, okay, now we're going to be putting in the anesthetic. You know, so just relax, and this will be taking effect.
But he says it didn't seem to be working.
So I start thinking about what they're going to be doing to me in half an hour. They're going to, like, take these knives, and they're going to cut me open. They're going to rip my intestines apart. Ugh. They're going to pull off this inflamed appendix. They're going to sew up the intestines. They're going to zip everything back up. And all this is going to happen, supposedly, without me being aware of it. And I'm not having any part of it. I was just lying there saying, I don't think this is working. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling anything. You're going to have to do something more. I just want you to know that I'm not. And then I was in another room, and there was no one else there. Where did they all go?
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Like, they had all left. And then it occurred to me, like, no, the whole surgery's already happened.
Wow, that is weird.
It's happened to me. It's as if they splice time, take the time that you were in and the time that you are in subsequently, and the middle is totally missing. No experience whatsoever.
It's not like sleep.
No.
There was no like, oh, I'm getting sleepy. Mm. I was arguing with my doctors that they didn't know how to do their job. And the next thing, I'm in a hospital room with my appendix out, and it's 10 hours later.
It sort of implies that it's like a switch.
It is. And that's what happens. I mean, when you raise the level of anesthesia in someone, and they've done studies on this, it isn't a gentle gradation down. You raise it up, and then, boom, you are into this other state.
Do people who do this for a living know exactly why this happened?
You'd think that something that's been around since 1846 would be hammered out solid. But it's still almost a philosophical kind of mystery.
There's a term for this in physics. It's called a black box.
It refers to a system where you can see what goes in, you can see that something different comes out.
And you wonder, like, what happened there in the middle?
But you can't see it.
Yeah.
It's a mystery.
It's black, and it's closed up, therefore the box.
I mean, it might not literally be a box, but today we have three different attempts
to open three very different black boxes.
Starting with the box that's in front of us now, that gap that Carl talked about where you go, boom.
You're gone.
And then, suddenly you're back. What happens in that gap?
That's what's crazy. It's been almost 170 years since William Morton did his thing in front of those med students, and we've moved way beyond ether.
So here we got propofol, we got sevoflurane, dexmedetomidine, ketamine.
We've got all these new drugs, but we still don't know exactly how they work. Which, for Patrick, is a very practical problem.
It's very difficult, actually, to figure out when people, you know, aren't conscious, because they can always be internally conscious to some degree, right?
And in the 1950s and 60s, he says, this became a real issue, because doctors started giving patients
Neuromuscular blocking agents
that would paralyze their muscles during surgery, so they wouldn't flop around, which is a good thing. But then you'd have these situations. Once in a blue moon, where a patient would wake up in the middle of surgery.
Literally trapped, unable to move.
Eyes closed, totally still.
You know, fully awake, but no one would be able to perceive it because they couldn't move.
And that's a nightmare that, you know, may even be worse than having six strong men hold you down.
Oof. We don't have to dwell on that.
Well, I actually did find a bunch of these stories.
I don't want to hear them.
No, they're great. I mean, they're amazing, but...
No.
All right.
I'd like to hear about it.
No.
I'm just saying.
Here, I'll just play you one.
No, no.
All right. You are going to regret it. But Well, anyway, the larger point is that if you can't understand how and why anesthesia works, then you're not going to be able to explain why every so often it just doesn't work.
Okay. Really? How often is every so often?
I've heard different numbers, anywhere between 1 in 10,000 to much more often, like 1 in 1,000.
Wow.
But luckily...
Let's take a look at these brain signals.
In the last few decades, scientists have begun to shine a little pin light into this black box. And Patrick and his team in particular have found something pretty cool.
This experiment that we did in the, I guess, late 2000s.
A couple years ago, they wanted to know what happens in the brain right when that switch flips. So they got a bunch of volunteers.
Healthy volunteers.
They hooked them up to an IV and started to very, very slowly give them propofol.
Slowly administer the drug.
Which is a big anesthetic. And as they did, they told the subjects to click a button beep. Every time they heard a sound or a word.
Chair, beep. A library.
That they recognized.
Submarine, beep. You know, something like that. In addition, we had the subject's name too. Tim, beep. Patrick.
Beep. So the subjects would just sit there and listen and click.
Chair, beep. A library.
On beep. And on.
Patrick.
And every 15 minutes, they gave them a little bit more propofol.
Submarine. Beep. Tim.
Beep.
Michael.
Beep.
Patrick.
Beep.
Patrick.
Until eventually...
They just stopped responding altogether.
They're just out cold. Now, throughout this whole time, Patrick and his team were measuring the brain waves of the subjects. That's the key. And he says what they saw right at the moment that switch flipped.
Right at the moment of loss of consciousness. There was just one really, really clear motif that appeared.
They saw this wave of electricity sweeping across the brain.
This really low frequency oscillation, about one cycle per second or less. And in addition to that, there was this higher frequency piece, an alpha wave that appeared at the front of the head at that loss of consciousness moment.
So when people went under, their brains just started to ring like a bell?
Basically.
And why would what are those waves doing exactly?
It seems like those waves might be imposing a kind of deadly order on the brain. Huh. This is the thing that's very counterintuitive. You think that consciousness is order and synchrony.
Yeah.
But it turns out that it's kind of the opposite, that consciousness is actually chaotic and noisy. It's all of those different parts of the brain, you know, facial recognition, touch, sound, language, engaged in this crazily complicated, multi-layered conversation.
You know, it's one person talking, the other one talking back.
This is Carl Zimmer again, and he says one of the hallmarks of the conscious brain is that you see a kind of conversational logic, a back and forth between the different parts.
Yeah, my turn, your turn, my turn, yeah. Your turn.
The things you're seeing create signals in the back of your head. They go to the front of your head. back again, forward and back, and forward and back, and forward and back, and forward and back. And you can use this eavesdropping to calculate how connected the brain is, what they call connectivity. And when you're awake, you have a lot of connectivity. When you're dreaming, you also have a lot of connectivity. And then if someone gives you anesthesia, like in a matter of a second, your connectivity just collapses.
Oh, maybe that's what happened to you. It just cut, your connectivity got cut.
It did.
And here is the weird part.
Scientists will like play a sound to somebody who's under with anesthesia. And they can see that actually the part of the brain that processes sound, the auditory cortex, is active. Oh. It takes in the sound. So your brain is hearing sounds.
That's spooky.
Yeah.
So what could be happening is that when you're under anesthesia, all the different parts of your brain, to some degree, they could be awake.
It's not your brain is just stopping.
No, all those parts of the brain are still talking. They're just not talking to each other
very well anymore.
And that somehow knocks you out.
So lots of chit-chat amongst the different parts of my brain make me conscious, and not so much chit-chat equals unconsciousness.
Yeah, that's the idea.
And how do the slow waves relate to that?
Well, Patrick thinks of it in sort of in baseball terms.
Right. So actually, I was at a Red Sox game the other day. It was the last one that they had with the Yankees at Fenway Park this year. And at some point, the wave started. So some part of the stadium decided to go into the wave. And here you go. The wave's coming around and coming around. And you're watching it. And it keeps coming around and coming around. And, you know, after a while, it gets really tiresome because you're sitting there and you're just like, okay, I've got to wait for the wave to come. Okay, here it is. And, okay, stand up, raise our arms, sit back down. And just a moment later, you're like, oh, my God, I got to stand up again. And you're waiting. Oh, dude, it's back again. And the thing is that when the wave is going on in the stadium, you can't really carry on a normal conversation. You can't have a normal interaction. You may not even be able to have a normal thought because the thing is just coming by every couple seconds to interrupt you. That is sort of the rationale for how these oscillations disrupt brain activity.
I dig the analogy, but I'm not quite following.
It helps to zoom in on the brain and look at a smaller number of neurons.
Okay.
Which is what he did.
Now check this out. We conducted this study where we measured brain activity in individual neurons.
They got some patients, planted these tiny little electrodes deep into their brains so they could hear the individual neurons.
So let's imagine that we zoom in to like tens to hundreds of neurons firing. And
he says when they give that patient propofol, an anesthetic,
what we notice is that right at the point of loss of consciousness,
sure enough, they see those big, slow waves sweeping through. And just like in Fenway, when the wave hits you, you have to stop your conversation. But what that wave is really doing is it's only allowing each little cluster of neurons to talk once in a while.
They can only fire at a particular moment in this slow oscillation.
Like, you know how the wave goes up and down, up and down, or round and round and round if you're in Fenway? It's only at this moment, say, that one group gets to talk. The problem is, as Buddy, he can only talk at this moment. And the neurons next door, they can only talk at this moment. Next group, same deal. Everybody gets a turn to talk, but they can't talk to each other because they're on slightly different schedules. When they're talking, the others can't listen. So there's still a lot of talking going on, but consciousness seems to be the brain talking and listening to itself. So when that slow wave rolls around,
the neurons can't all fire at the same time and talk to one another. And in that state, it would be impossible to be conscious.
It might be early to say, but does it feel kind of like you cracked the code?
Well, I think we are in the process of cracking the code for anesthesia. You don't ever want to get, you know, too far out on a limb. But honestly, I mean, I feel if we can educate people about these rhythms, I'd be willing to say it. Sure, I think we have. I mean, I think this is going to be huge. I'm not going to lie to you. I think this is just going to be absolutely huge. Yeah, I'll take the bait on that. Sure.
Crack the code? Really? That's a little bold.
Well, what it means to Patrick.
Housekeeping turnover team, anesthesia turnover 38, case to follow.
Is that in very practical terms, He can now peek into that black box of the brain.
Okay, here I am. I'm wearing my scrubs.
For example, Patrick and his colleague, Emery Brown.
I'm an anesthesiologist here at Mass General.
They let me watch a couple surgeries, and I met a woman named Doris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What kind of surgery are you having today?
I'm going to have the repairing of hernias.
It's a surgery that, you know, 170 years ago would have been unthinkable. But here she is.
I feel comfortable.
Not too worried.
So they're about to give her the first anesthetic. First anesthetic propofol.
That's right, yep.
And as she starts to go under...
Deep breath, Doris. In and out. Don't stop, Doris.
So I'm going to just switch over to the spectrogram display and see what it shows us.
Deep breath, Doris.
On one of these monitors...
Oh, look at that. Did you see that change?
Yeah. It's this color display. You can actually see it happen.
You can see the slow waves, right?
Now she's got some slow oscillation.
If you imagine the screen as like this field of blues and yellows and greens, suddenly these bands of red just extend right along the bottom. And considering that for the last 160 years, anytime somebody like Doris has been put on a table and cut open, the doctors basically couldn't be sure what was going on in their head. Are they awake? Are they okay? And so with that in mind, being there in the operating room and seeing that band of red appear on the screen and hearing Emery Brown declare without hesitation,
this patient is unconscious.
It's kind of cool.
And you say that with what percent confidence?
Oh, 99.999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999
And then I was in another room. Where did they all go?
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.